We had a great show on Thursday, May 30th. We welcomed former heavyweight boxer Jerry Cooney. He talked about his new book and his years in the ring and his battle with alcohol addiction. We also welcomed Professor Alan Sanders from St. Peter's University talking about what's going on in Washington. And we wrapped it up with college admissions expert Peter Van Buskirk. And joining us right now is a gentleman I grew up watching. And it's a thrill when I get to talk to people who actually I have memories of, and really good memories, and a guy that and people that I can talk to people about. Joining us right now is Jerry Cooney, one of the greatest heavyweight boxers in my mind of all time. He's got a brand new book out, Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. Jerry Cooney, Paul Pacelli here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Paulie, I want to tell you something. Start off. When you said when you were growing up, it sounds like I'm so old. What the hell?
You're only, you know, Jerry, you're a little older than me, so maybe I shouldn't use the word growing up too.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Listen, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to be on your show. Heard nothing but great stuff about it. I'm feeling terrific. I've been busy as anything. And I'm excited about life. I've got a lot of things going on. Obviously, my book is coming out in a couple of weeks, and it's very exciting.
June 19th. June 12th. I'm sorry, Jerry. June 19th. Did you always think you would write a book like this, Jerry? Did you think coming up and then afterwards, and we'll get into your battle with addiction and your memories in the ring, did you always want to put this onto a page?
Well, you know what happened is that, no, I did not. I did not think that. But, you know, life, real life takes turns that we're not expecting. We're not paying attention to, and we get stuck sometimes, and we get lost along the road. And this is a great story because it's you get knocked down in life, mm-hmm. and you're able to get up, dust off your pants, and move on, turn the page and move on, because life ain't waiting for us.
No, it certainly isn't. Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. Jerry, before we had a break there for traffic, you were talking about getting knocked down and getting up. Americans, people really love, I think, Jerry, you know, stories like you, of course, the Rocky franchise, the Raging Bull. People really, I think, Jerry, identify with fighters, right? With boxers. It's a microcosm of life.
Well, you know, everybody identifies with the fight of life. I mean, listen, we got to work 2-3 jobs. We got to get home to the family. We got to make the bills meet. And fighting is about that. You know, if I'm working 3 jobs, when I come home on Saturday night and Jerry Cooney's fighting and I'm a fan of his, I'm praying he's going to knock the guy out because that's going to give me strength. And that's the way it was for me watching Ali and Frazier and Roberto Duran and Ray Leonard. You know, we put our hearts in those guys and we watch them grow, and they give us a little more strength.
It's interesting. It's interesting you mention that because my son, when he was small, and he's 25 now, he would say, you know, Dad, why are you cheering for this boxer or that boxer? And it was weird to try to answer that, Jerry, because, you know, you can't tell a 5 or 6-year-old about an emotional connection, but that's a profound question that comes from a kid, you know?
Yeah, it is a very profound question, and it's great to allow that kid to keep asking those questions. See, I grew up in a household where we couldn't talk. We had to keep quiet. My father was a raging alcoholic. Little did I know that set me up in my life to have a problem with alcohol, and that's what eventually happened to me, and I had a lot of anger. I talked about how I became a fighter was boxing, you know, expressed my anger. I could go to the gym and punch people. And then they put my picture in the paper, so it made me somebody, and it kept me alive. I didn't wind up on the streets in the bad places. I was able to control it better.
When you were working a heavy bag or a speed bag, Jerry, in the gym, and probably you obviously did that for hours and hours, were you not only hitting that bag, were you hitting people that hurt you?
Well, I wanted to survive, and, you know, boxing is like, you know, you're a gladiator. And when you get in the ring, you climbed up them 4 steps, and you waited for the bell to ring. When the bell rang, I have a sword, he's got a sword. Mm. And my job is to get him first. So, yeah, I mean, we're in a fight. You know, we're always in a fight, and people can identify with that fight. Yeah. I mean, I show kids. I go to some, way with kids' homes, and I work with kids. And I show them a highlight of my film, and they don't know me, but they identify with the fight of life. And they become... Right away, I'm accepted into the house.
You mentioned, and obviously this is recounted in your book, not all your great fights, and we'll talk about some of those, but your tough life. And you talk about this book being, you know, a book that illustrates how you overcame a lot of things, your addiction. So let me backtrack to what you said before. Growing up was tough, you said.
Well, yeah, obviously, you know, we kind of hit out. We all had our, I had five brothers and sisters, and we all had our own hiding spots. Mm. And mine was in the basement, and it took me a long time to be able to come out of that basement and to understand that, you know, that I could raise my hand. I could ask for help. I could help allow somebody to help me. I didn't know that. I was told, keep your mouth shut, sit in the back of the room, don't raise your hand. And so, unfortunately, we grew up that way. We don't know any better. Mm. And then we get angry, and then we're mad. And I remember my father built the ring in the backyard when I was 17, and he used to box me. My mother would keep time through the kitchen window, and I could have hurt him, but I couldn't hit him back in the day. As angry as I was about what was going on, and I was to find out later on, thank God I didn't hit him, because I did speak to someone down the road mm-hmm. who did that, and it wasn't a pleasant experience. And so I was glad that I never really opened up with my father. And, you know, my father died at a young age. I was 18 years old. I was in part of the story is told is I got invited to the finals of the Olympic trials yeah. in 1976. And I got the phone call, and he asked me, listen, you made the team. You want to come to Colorado Springs? I said, you know, I really can't. My father said, he said, are you sure? This is the Olympics. You want to come? I said, I can't. My father said, three times. He said, okay, I'm sorry. And he hung up the phone. And that was about 10% true. 90% was I didn't have the self-esteem. I wasn't confident enough. Why am I going to go look like an ass in Colorado Springs?
Wow.
When I look back today, I wish I had the opportunity just to take the shot.
That was one of that was one of the greatest U.S. boxing teams of all time.
It was. And
Ray Leonard was on that squad.
Howard Davis, the late Howard Davis. Everybody was on that. The Spinks brothers, John Tate. And I never took the chance to go out there and to give it a shot. And that's partly from my upbringing and not having a lot of confidence in myself. And then, you know, as time went on, you know, we had to climb. I had to get in the ring with guys like Jimmy Young in Atlantic City. I had to get in the ring with Ron Lyle in the Coliseum and Kenny Norton in Madison Square Garden. Mm. I mean, you know, to climb up those four steps, it wasn't easy. But I knew once the bell rang, I was going to fight. And that's the fight that we all take in life. We have to make that choice, and we get in, and the bell rings, we're going to have to go.
Did you think, in the midst of all this abuse, was part of you saying, Dad does care about me, maybe he loves me, but he just can't express it, or he won't do it? That must have been very troubling for you.
I'll tell you, when I was 17, I was running away from home. I purposely didn't leave till 4:45, when he would normally be driving down the street to come home. And I had a bag in my hand, and I was hoping he was going to drive down the street and pull over and say, Jerry, come on, let's go home and straighten this out. And then he didn't even show up that night.
Wow.
And I just left and moved away at 17. And that's what happened. But listen, there's a lot of worse stories than mine.
Sure.
There's a lot of more pain than mine. I was very lucky that I was able to stop picking up alcohol and find some great people who could help me along my way. And, man, I tell you what, I'm living a dream right now. I love people. I'm on SiriusXM every Monday, mm-hmm. every Friday on channel 156 from 6 to 8 p.m. with Randy Gordon. And I have my book coming out. There's a movie. They're talking about doing a movie about a Rocky film.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of great stuff. And, you know, I just keep trying to do the next right thing.
The book is Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, Champion of Recovery. Jerry Cooney is with us. So let's go to the whole boxing thing here, Jerry, if we can for a moment. Your first fight, February 15th, 1977. You're what, 20, 21 years old. You get in a ring and
19.
I'm sorry, bad math here. And you KO Bill Jackson in a minute and a half. Talk to me. What was it like? I mean, obviously you had trained, and you had some amateur fights. Obviously, a lot of them.
You
climb in the ring and you say to yourself, "Okay, this is for real now." Take me back to that.
Well, you know, I didn't really have any understanding of how to feel that. I never learned how to feel. It was either happy or angry for me. And I had a coach named Capo Bianco, and I watched his son turn pro, and it was a very exciting thing with his family. I didn't have any of that. I was alone. And so I turned pro, and I was going into the ring. I had to prove my father was wrong all these years. I wanted to see how far I could go. And so Bill Jackson was my first guy. I was in great shape, and I went in the ring, and obviously I caught him and knocked him out of there. And it was, to be honest with you, I didn't know how to feel.
Wow.
That experience. But now looking back, when I wrote this book and all the stories we wrote and things that were going on, I got to relive it again. And that was part of the healing process, is by sitting down and spending time with a great John Grady, an author, and going through these stories and picking the ones we wanted. And, wow, what an experience to have gotten through it and to be where I am today.
Get this, quote, "Jerry is a hell of a man. If he would have waited 1 year later, he would have been heavyweight champion of the world. To me, he is a great man, and I always liked him, and we will always be friends." That, of course, the great Jerry Cooney, Larry Holmes, who you fought and lost a tough decision. In fact, I was watching it online on YouTube the other night, and that was your first loss, right? You were 25-0 at that point, correct?
I was, and I'm still trying to get a rematch from him. He won't give it to me. Yeah, so we had a great night, and, it got ugly. There was racism, but it wasn't anything about him, and it wasn't anything about me. It was just the people trying to make money from the fight that made it so distasteful that I was so angry when I got in the ring. All I wanted to do was hit him with one left hook.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was, when we got instructions from Mills Lane, Holmes looked at me and said, "Jerry, let's have a good fight."
Uh-huh.
And that's what heavyweight boxing is really about.
Did it bother you, Jerry, at all throughout your great career that you were labeled the Great White Hope? By some people, did that bother you?
You know what? I had six or seven guys I grew up with. They came along with my training camps and we hung out. It was a time of my life. I had no time to think about racism and all the other stuff. Listen, I was living the dream. I was going to fight for the heavyweight championship of the world. Do you think I had time to think about that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people talked about it. The press brought it up to me, but I just never paid attention to it because it wasn't about what I was doing. I was trying to go as far as I could go.
Were you controlling your addictions, your alcoholism? Was that under control while you were fighting?
No, it was not. And after the Norton fight, that's where everything went crazy, and I guess the pressure got to me from growing up in a family like I did, and it kind of started to get to me, stress, and what was I really doing? I heard I was no good. I was a failure. I was never going to amount to anything. All of a sudden, now I'm fighting for the heavyweight championship of the world. It doesn't make sense. And unconsciously, I think that pressure hit me, and I started to drink, and that big hole that I carried around all my life in my chest when I drank went away. And so that became my friend, and that was a big mistake. And obviously it took me a bunch of years till 1988, April 21st, 1988, when I finally put it all down. And
mm-hmm.
I have 31 years right now without a drink, and I'm so excited about my life and the positive, decision-making and options and plans. They were all just fantastic.
You fought in what I like to refer to, Jerry, when I talk to younger people now who may not be so much into boxing, but it's the old MMA and everything. You, I think, Jerry, were in the golden age of heavyweights. Yourself and Ali at the tail end, but Ken Norton, Larry Holmes, Ron Lyle, Michael Spinks, George Foreman before George gave made his comeback. I really hope, Jerry, that we have a guy like Deontay Wilder now and some other heavyweights. I really long for the days, Jerry, when the heavyweight, you could go up and down the street and everybody would talk heavyweight boxing. It's not that way anymore.
Well, I think that it's on its way back. We have a great guy fighting. Although he's from England, his name is Anthony Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
He is such a great man, and he's got a great amateur pedigree, and he dropped Klitschko and won and kept his championship. He's a great fighter. Deontay Wilder is a great fighter. Tyson Fury is a great fighter. And we have a lot of other guys in the heavyweight division coming up. But, years ago, if the heavyweight division was terrible, boxing was terrible.
Yeah.
Now, these other divisions like light heavyweight, middleweight, welterweight, we got Terrence Crawford and Errol Spence. We got some great fights out there. And so we have to just be patient a little bit. And these guys are showing themselves.
You talked about patience, Jerry, and we're talking with Jerry Cooney. this generation now, and I have a son in his mid-20s, so I saw the whole evolution of him growing up with all the social media and Twitter and everything. That's why I've always loved boxing, Jerry, and what you guys did back then and still do. It's why they call it a sweet science. It's not a 5 or 10, it's not a 5 or 10 minute thing. I mean, back when there were 12 and 15 round fights, I mean, you really had to plan out a strategy, correct?
You had to have a make adjustments. I mean, you know, listen, here's the deal. Like in boxing, when we were fighting, you had Eddie Futch, Victor Val, you had Gil Clancy, you had so many great trainers. Those guys have passed on. And the problem is that the guys that have jumped into the game now that are training, they don't have the pedigree. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the communication to talk to the fighter and to make adjustments in between rounds. You know, and that's the problem with boxing, and it's getting watered down because of that. But there are great trainers. I'm in the business. I started training up fighters. I have a gym, opened up a gym, and I'm training fighters to bring back the real sweet science where you can, you know, talk to your guy and say, well, listen, I remember Manuel Steele was telling Lennox Lewis, listen, when you go out this round, instead of throwing the straight right hand, throw it 6 inches more to the right. Next round, Lennox Lewis went out and knocked the guy out. Because you can make that adjustment. But the guys that are training today, they don't know that those kinds of ins and outs. And we have to bring that back to boxing. But boxing is big right now and strong. You know, even, I mean, I wouldn't say as big as when in the 80s and 70s and 80s, 90s. But we are getting there. We're getting there. There's a lot of talent with The Zone, with ESPN, with Showtime. I mean, there's a lot of great talent out there.
There's plenty. If you want to find it, there's plenty of good boxing out there.
Oh,
absolutely. Well, Jerry, it's been a pleasure. Once again, here's the book, Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. It comes out actually June 12th, but you can pre-order it on Amazon and all these other sites. And Jerry said that there may be a movie deal in the works, so Jerry, we'll cross our fingers on that one. Jerry Cooney, it's been a pleasure, my man. Thank you so much.
Love you, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. The great Jerry Cooney, ladies and gentlemen. There it is, Jerry Cooney. Go back on his career, most of his fights in and around New York City. He overcame addiction, an abusive father. Jerry Cooney, 28-3 in his career, in his 31 decisions. 28-3, 24 wins by knockout, 3 by decision, 1 by disqualification. Was 25-0 before he lost to Larry Holmes to drop his record to 25-1, and then losses to Michael Spinks and George Foreman, ending his career. But he also defeated Eddie Gregg, Ken Norton, Ron Lyle, Jimmy Young, Eddie Lopez, some top-notch fighters. Our next guest is a former Time Magazine reporter who currently teaches political science, poli-sci, at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. You see him on many major market TV and radio stations, as well as all the news networks talking about all things political. It is a fascinating time, and he probably, like me, is stocking up on the popcorn. Professor Alan Sanders joined us. Professor, how are you?
Very good, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, I'm kind of a barrage being fired at the White House here. First, your impressions of what Bob Mueller did earlier this week, beneficial for one side or the other side, or is this a wash?
Well, of course, it depends on who you speak, but I think it's important. It was important for him, and I think it was also important for Democrats overall, broadly speaking, because he wanted to stress two very important points which have kind of been overshadowed. The first one, of course, was the first part of his report and the first part of his press conference. He pointed out that Russian interference had been, in fact, the case for the 2016 election. It was pervasive, it was systematic, and that the danger continues. And he wanted to make that clear because the White House has been so dismissive of Russian interference, and one really wonders how much effort they have put into making sure that it doesn't happen again. Now, of course, elections are the basic element of all democracies, and if the election system is corrupted in any way, especially by a foreign adversary, that is a very serious matter, and I think Bob Mueller wanted to make that point very clear. And that's something the Democrats have argued for and made a major point in their political agenda. The second point, of course, was what what conclusions did Mueller reach in terms of obstruction of justice? And Mr. Mueller made clear that but for the Justice Department policy of not prosecuting a sitting president, he believed that the president was not exonerated by the evidence. And that's an important statement that he wanted to stress, and it, of course, is a statement that supports Democratic claims for continued investigation of the president.
Not exonerated. That's what everybody's going to look at, Professor Sanders. And now we come to all the legal twisting and turning, where, of course, the Republicans are saying, well, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't prosecuted either. But the Democrats are going to say, but wait a minute, he wasn't cleared either. Professor Alan Sanders, political science professor, St. Peter's University, Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor, back to your point about the fact that Mr. Mueller made it clear and pretty much reiterated what he said in the printed version of the report, that he could not clear the president on obstruction charges.
Well, that's right. And the reason, of course, he cited was this Justice Department policy that says that the department will not prosecute a sitting president. Now, that is interesting because that really is just a policy. It's a point of view by the Justice Department, which, of course, is a self-interested executive agency talking about the executive branch. The Supreme Court has never ruled that a sitting president cannot be indicted, prosecuted, or tried. In fact, the Constitution is quite clear that these are impeachment and criminal prosecution are two very separate processes, and there's no statement in the Constitution that says anything about the order of one over the other or the contemporaneous pursuit of both. So this is simply a statement, a viewpoint of the Justice Department, and of course there are legal scholars who will tell you that the Justice Department is wrong.
It's interesting, Professor. It's always, I guess when I try to explain this to people, it's almost like a gentleman's agreement, meaning, and I had it explained to me once, saying, well, you cannot to criminally prosecute the leader of the free world would unnecessarily tie up the American government and, you know, defense interests around the world and whatever. You have to remove him first and then criminally prosecute him. Is that what the point that some people make?
Well, that may be the point that some people make. The other point is that he is the head of the executive branch, and as the head of the executive branch, he is, in a sense, the chief prosecutor, and it's kind of contrary to the fact that the chief prosecutor should be prosecuting himself. There's that argument that's made, too. But the Constitution simply says, look, impeachment is a removal from office.
Yeah.
And that's all it amounts to. And then separately, there is a criminal prosecution for criminal wrongdoing. And the Constitution doesn't make a presumption as to which one should go first.
The Democrats are in kind of a quandary here. I don't agree with her much on policy. I have, though, in the past few days, started to feel very sorry for Nancy Pelosi. Because, obviously, House Speaker... you know, it was a tough gig. It was, I saw an interview once with John Boehner in which he referred to it as trying to herd cats. And she's really got her hands full with the various factions of her party on this.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, the speakership under the control of any party is very difficult. I mean, you saw Paul Ryan having great difficulty with his party stalwarts, and now, of course, Nancy Pelosi, because, of course, the parties are not unified. They have factions, and each faction will push for whatever agenda it believes is more productive. Of course, she faces a difficult situation here, because certainly there's the more liberal wing of her party that says, okay, look, there's enough evidence here at least to start impeachment proceedings. But then she's got a more moderate wing of her party, 30 or 40 members of whom just recently got elected in what were considered to be Trump districts. And none of those 30 or 40 have been agitating for impeachment because they think that that might hurt their electoral chances.
Mm-hmm.
So Nancy Pelosi is trying to walk the middle here and trying to figure out what would be electorally advantageous for Democrats in order to keep their majority and in order to defeat the Republicans, both in the Senate and hopefully, she believes, for the presidency. And so that's what's going on, politics here, as opposed to actual evidentiary motivations.
Yeah, Professor Alan Sanders, once again, the guest, former Time Magazine reporter, currently poli-sci professor, instructor at St. Peter's University in Jersey City. Yeah, it's tough, Professor, because, listen, they I'm sure there's, again, a good part of her caucus that wants to come down like a sledgehammer. But, again, when you're dealing with a president who, and I know there are economists who go both ways on this, when you have an economy that seems to be chugging along, when, you know, you have these numbers that seem to be favoring possibly his reelection, it really is a delicate balance to strike here, because electoral politics can change on a dime. It's that old pendulum. It was really good for the Democrats, in 2018, might not be so good, but who knows in 2020?
Well, that's right, and the situation is such that all kinds of political assumptions have been thrown up in the air, and you don't know how they're going to fall back down to the ground. Certainly, an economy, a good economy, works for the president, and it works for a president in midterm elections. It did not for this president in the last midterms. So so that argument that the economy is going well, and there's polling that suggests that people certainly like the economy going well, but they're not voting or they're not thinking too much about the economy. They seem to be more preoccupied by the president's personality and the shenanigans on in Washington. And that doesn't look to work too well for the president.
Well, exactly, yeah. Professor. Yeah, if I could step in there. And you made the point is excellent, because it seems to me, Professor Sanders, that all of that conventional wisdom kind of gets tossed out here, because you have a guy, and I say this in jest, okay, tongue in cheek, but you have a guy who probably, if he walked out of the White House down the front driveway where they set up those microphones all the time, if he came out waving in his hand, "Here, I have the cure for cancer," people may take it, but they still wouldn't reelect him because of the personal dislike they have for the guy.
Well, that's right. And, of course, this is something that people who support the president don't seem to quite understand. Of course, they understand that Democrats and opponents of the president don't like him and oppose him. But I'm not sure they completely understand the depth with which people do not like the president. And that has always surprised them. I said, as much as you might have detested Barack Obama, as many of these supporters of Trump will attest to, I say you do not begin to realize the depth of the animosity that opponents of this president have towards him. And so we really have a very deeply polarized population, and that makes the politics in any kind of compromise very difficult to achieve.
And again, obviously you've studied this, it's part of your job, but if you look at what happened last time around with some of the polling, add to that, Professor Sanders, and I've said this on this show, with Donald Trump, I believe you will always have a hidden vote for him. We kind of saw it the first time around, and you'll likely have it this time around of people who may not in pleasant company want to discuss it or tell it to a pollster, but I think his support is a couple of points deeper than people think it is.
Well, that may well be, and certainly that was part of the speculation and analysis after the last election. But what one should always remember, and I think we always forget this, is that any president, this one included, has an unshakable base of support. Mm-hmm. That was true for Barack Obama. It was true for George Bush, George W. Bush. And, of course, it's true for Donald Trump. So you're never going to shake these folks off of their support for whoever they believe is their president. What you really have to look for is what's everybody else thinking? What is the opposition? How broad is the support of the opposition? And how broad is that great middle, which can swing either way? And so, you know, we see the president addressing his rallies and everybody is cheering for him, and that's true. Those folks will always cheer for him. There's nothing he can do or say that will deter them from supporting him. But is that the whole country? And when you take a look at the broader country, and certainly when you take a look at the last results of the midterm elections, there's plenty to worry Republicans, because the House elections in the last midterm election were as close as you could get to a general election about the state of the country. And to the extent that it was, it certainly demonstrated that the president's support was weak in major parts of the country that he thought were his. And I would add another point here, and we should all pay attention to the fact that who is he focusing on as his main rival, and who is he criticizing most deeply these days? It's Joe Biden.
Sure.
Because Joe Biden appeals to the same kind of constituency that led to Trump's success in the presidential election. So clearly he understands that he has support, but he also understands that his support is not as solid as he once thought it was.
Final segment with our guest, Professor Alan Sanders, former Time magazine reporter, currently teaches political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. And we thank him very much for his availability today. We talked, Professor, you did a few seconds ago, about Joe Biden. He's got a pretty good lead so far over the president in a one-to-one matchup. Of course, it's early. Seems to be maintaining a lead among Democrats here. He would be 78 or thereabouts if he was inaugurated. And as far as a running mate, a possible running mate, you and I both know that Democrats only win elections when black and women voters show up. It would be interesting to see how he would maintain a vigorous image in the months to come, and also who his running mate might be.
Well, that's right. And that's an important constituency, an important or two important core constituencies among Democrats. I think what we need to see in order to understand who the vice presidential candidate would be for any of the presidential candidates, you have to see how the primaries unfold. Those who make a strong showing or demonstrate a strong core constituency that will vote for them are the primary candidates, of course, for the vice president. Because what's the real role of the vice president? In terms of governance, there's nothing there really except to break a tie for the Senate if it ever occurs, and that's a rare occurrence. So the real role of the vice president is to round out a ticket and to have some electoral relevance and bring in various constituencies that are important to win the election. So Joe Biden, of course, will want to be clear, and I think he's going to be clear-eyed about this, about who he needs if were he to become the nominee, who he would need to round out the ticket. But I would say that's also true of all the other candidates.
Yeah.
The president or the presidential candidate is only one person, and he or she is who he or she is. And one of the ways you broaden the appeal is with the vice president.
They talk about Achilles heel issues for each party. It's pretty obvious that as far as issues, Democrats will go after the Republicans and the president, likely now on abortion and or health care. Do the Democrats have a possible Achilles heel, Professor Sanders, on immigration?
Well, yes, they do, because, of course, everybody, I think, wants legal immigration, but everybody, I would assume, or at least most people, are opposed to illegal immigration. So the real question is, how do you secure the border, and how do you deal humanely with those who have crossed and are now living in the United States illegally? Clearly, the federal government has an important role in protecting the sovereignty of the United States of America. And sovereignty means you are in control of your borders, you're in control of what goes on inside the country. If you're not in control of your borders and you're not in control of what goes on in your country, then you start to lose the elements of sovereignty, and other states begin to wonder whether you actually mean what you say. So it is important to be a sovereign state, and a sovereign state controls its borders. But how to do so humanely and how to do so effectively is a point of debate. But of course, we miss that debate because we're all focused on this wall. And, you know, you either are for the wall or you're not for the wall. But the debate about what would really secure the United States gets overshadowed by that almost pointless debate. The real debate is what works and what would be most effective.
And final question, Professor, no matter who wins, either the Democratic primary or if they were to win the presidency, I think most people will agree, and I think we're seeing a little bit of it now. Donald Trump, whether he's a one-termer, a half-termer, or a two-termer, he really has kind of rewritten the rule book for future campaigns and presidents. I would suspect that a lot of people who will criticize him at the drop of a hat are also taking notes, especially when it comes to social media, speech giving, appearances. What do you think of that?
No, I don't think so. I'm one of those who believes that really his presidency, whether it's a one- or a two-term presidency, could be just a blip. No president is going to want to emulate the insults that this president engages in. No president is going to want to pursue the chaotic kind of administration that this president has instilled. What will be interesting and what could set a precedent is that although the president's tweets are really offensive on many occasions, what he has shown is that there is benefit to a president to deal directly with the American people.
Yeah, that's essentially what... essentially, Professor, what I meant. Not policy-wise, but the mechanics of the whole thing.
Well, yes, but I mean, I think I would limit it really to tweets because I don't really see much else that this president has done which other presidents would want to emulate. For instance, he has really cut short press conferences. His press secretary gives almost no press conferences. I don't see that as a precedent that future presidents would want to pursue. Making speeches using the bully pulpit, well, that's been a technique that's been used for many decades now. So I don't think the president is using that in any new novel way. I think the way he has dealt with that that's new, but I don't think most presidents will want to follow that in the future, is to call the news media fake, to accuse it of unpatriotism, and to avoid the press in terms of through his press secretary. I don't see future presidents using that technique because usually the press works for the benefit of the president and not to the detriment of the president.
Our guest has been Professor Alan Sanders, a former Time magazine reporter who currently teaches political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. I've actually been there a couple of times to broadcast a few games. Professor Sanders, thank you so much. We know you're busy. We appreciate you taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Paul. Anytime. And you have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, Professor. You too. There you go. Professor Alan Sanders, former Time magazine reporter, now teaching poli-sci at Jersey City, New Jersey's St. Peter's University. Our next guest, I actually have the pleasure of listening in on a lecture that he gave at my son's school several years ago. I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago. And he lectures on the admissions game. And it is college admissions expert Peter Van Buskirk joins us. Peter, Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. Good to be with you.
Yeah, Peter, you were because this whole admission scandal thing has been in the news, and now people talking about the efficacy of getting into school and our 4-year colleges better than trade schools. I mean, you've seen all this stuff popping up. You did have, and I remember being very impressed with how you laid out this topic when you were at the Hampden Hall School several years ago here in Connecticut. You were in the middle of this whole admissions process when you worked at some of these colleges, correct?
Right. I was at Franklin and Marshall College for 25 years. I was the dean of admission there for about a dozen years. So I was part of the decision making process.
Yeah, people hear that and the whole thing, a dean of admissions, like people know what that is, Peter, but they kind of don't know what that is. How would you define that position?
Well, these days, the position is encompassing a lot of things, ranging from the identification of potential applicants, the recruitment of those students into the applicant pool, the selection of those students from the applicant pool that the institution wants, and then the enrollment of those students. So it's become a pretty comprehensive thing. We now regard the role of more strategic enrollment management, which is an idea that kind of emerged over the last 15 to 20 years. Used to be we were gatekeepers, now we're strategic enrollment managers.
That's a pretty heavy title there, Peter, strategic enrollment managers, right? How was it, and you said it has changed, it has evolved. Why is that? Talk a little about the evolution there of what you just said.
Wow, do we have an hour and a half?
I tell you what, I don't want to cut you off. Peter, seriously, hang on. I got to go to a quick traffic update here. Something going on. The guest, Peter Van Buskirk, joins us here for a few minutes. Founder and president of Best College Fit. Check him out, bestcollegefit.com. So, Peter, before we had a break there for traffic and weather, I asked you about the evolution of what you did in your college admission days and how it's become so selective now. Go ahead.
Well, it's really a combination of factors. Sometimes I refer to it as a perfect storm that began to emerge out of the 1980s when demographic factors, financial factors that would have a bearing on the market, if you will, of the college-going population. So now, the suggestion, for example, was that there were going to be dramatically fewer students of college-bound age, and that the support for higher education was going to drop significantly from the federal government. This is in the 1980s, mm-hmm. which got the attention of colleges and put them into a position where they started to be more aggressive about marketing to kids. But the gas on the fire was really the rankings that came out in 1983, which presumed to quantify the mythical pecking order. And ever since, colleges and universities have sort of been driven by a need to maintain or improve upon the rankings that they have. And that means that it's no longer good enough to get the class. We have to look good in the process.
Yeah, so in other words, just the way people used to and still look at the, you know, the AP Top 25 in football, you see these constant rankings that come out Newsweek and Forbes. Yeah. And I got to, and Peter, I got to admit, I look and see where my alma mater, BU, is. I look and my son went to Muhlenberg in Allentown, loved it. And, okay, let's see if my tuition money is making any bit of difference. So, yeah, being as number tidy as we are, we look at those things.
Well, the reality is that there's very little, if anything, happening on college campuses that really affects change. I mean, change in higher education is glacial in nature. So, but what has happened over the last 30 years, plus years, is that institutions have become much more aggressive about managing their presentation and managing the way they present the data that describes their processes. And, for example, in the absence of a metric that reliably reflects quality, the whole concept of selectivity, what percentage of our applicants have been admitted, has become a proxy for quality. So institutions are constantly developing strategies to try to become more selective so that the world would believe that they are better schools, when in fact they haven't changed at all.
And you also see the one I laugh at, you know, is our average SAT score. Oh, it's nice, but what does that mean, really? I don't know.
Well, increasingly, it's a good question, because there are more students opting out of the test, mm-hmm. Because many colleges and universities have made it optional to apply without having to submit those test results. And, of course, there are a lot of kids who get involved with test preparation, in many cases, improving their scores by 100-150 points on an SAT, which to the point of access and inclusion, really speaks to the question of, is our playing field really that level? Because there are a lot of populations that just don't have access to the kind of academic supports and test preparation that the, you know, maybe some more privileged populations would have.
And you saw, Peter, obviously, where the College Board came out a couple of weeks ago and said they're now going to add a I forgot what they call the number, but they're going to add what are they going to call it? I forgot.
And an adversity index.
Yes, to kind of address the things that you just talked about.
Exactly. And it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I think that in many communities, that index will probably capture, at least at first blush, the circumstances of a student's performance. But even within the community, it's going to be hard to really flesh out what an individual kid's doing. For example, my kids went to, and we lived in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where my kids went to a school that might otherwise be described as an urban school district with a graduation rate, a graduation rate from high school of about 50-60%, which is not real great.
No.
And so you think, wow, these kids need a break. And my kids lived in a part of the community that had some of the advantages that others didn't. My kids had access to the advanced placement and international baccalaureate program. So that adversity index will not accurately reflect my kids' situation. Now, they're out of college now, so it really won't come into play. But my point is that it's an imperfect tool, and I suspect we'll see more work done on it over the next couple of years to try to refine it.
Peter Van Buskirk, founder and president of Best College Fit, is the guest here on WICC. Peter, I remember in the presentation you gave at Hampton Hall, one of the most interesting parts that I always cite is somebody, it wasn't me, but I know somebody asked that inevitable, you know, the inevitable question, Peter, why does college cost so much? And you illustrated the circle of life of tuition setting and federal student loan money and how that plays in. Talk to our listeners a little about that, because I'm sure you get that. That's the question you hear in your sleep, I'm sure.
Well, it's true, and the cost of educating a student is really quite expensive. And I think when people look at a $60,000-$70,000 price tag, they're thinking that's too much. They can't justify that. Well, the reality is that when you look at the operating budget for an undergraduate education divided by the number of students who are enrolled, you can come to a pretty quick conclusion about what the total cost of educating that student would be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the costs that are not often seen by families would be the cost of the classroom themselves. It costs to install and maintain labs and up to date or state of the art facilities. What I was struck by in my experience was the cost of recruiting and hiring faculty. When you want to have a top rate chemist in your department, you're competing with the pharmaceutical industry to get that person on staff, and you have to pay competitive salaries. So there are those factors. There's the need to provide for faculty resources and facilities for them to do research and extended scholarly work. And those are some of the essentials. And some people would claim that some colleges are doing things now that they don't really need to do, mm-hmm. with climbing walls and single rooms for students and that sort of a thing. But I think that there are real costs to education that are often unseen. And I was able to spend a couple of years working in the provost office at Franklin and Marshall.
Yeah, you told me about that.
It just stunned me that for years, while other operating expenses went up for the institution, the cost of the academic program, in other words, the supporting the students in the classroom, maintained stagnant for years upon years. And it's largely because money was going to other parts of the institution. So the costs are real. It's just that state universities, for example, get subsidies from the state legislatures to reduce the cost. And some of the wealthier private schools are able to offer financial aid that can help reduce the cost for students who may not be able to afford the full bill.
Is there too much? I remember you spoke on this a little bit. The ready availability, and it has changed over the past few years with now the feds controlling all of it, the amount of readily, easily available federal student loans plays into this as well, doesn't it?
Well, yes, and it's not just the student loans. Students need to qualify for the federal loans based on the family's income situation. What happens, though, is that some institutions will sponsor other loans that come from their own coffers. So it's possible the student might have a guaranteed student loan, mm-hmm. of $3,500 in the first year, and then maybe if it's a high-need student, perhaps a Perkins loan of another $1,500. But then the institution might say, well, we're going to make an institutional financing option available to you as well for, let's say $10,000.
Yeah.
And, that's when the debt starts to rise. My advice to families is to remember that when you're looking at college costs and looking at the financial aid awards that colleges offer, that all parts of those financial aid awards are optional. Borrowing, for example, is a choice. And I strongly encourage families to look for institutions, colleges and universities, that will value their kids for what they have to offer. When a young person is valued in the admission process, she will be admitted and she will be supported financially in a way that will make it possible for her to attend. So, yes, there's an awful lot of variability in the way colleges deal with money and financial aid. But the reality is that if families are discerning about the way colleges treat students and where their individual students might fit in the competitive process, they can actually find good opportunities, good deals financially.
Peter Van Buskirk is the guest. Peter, hang on. We'll do one more segment with you. And yes, a few remaining minutes with Peter Van Buskirk. He's the founder and president of bestcollegefit.com. Go check it out, bestcollegefit.com. Peter gives presentations all over the country and answers a lot of questions that folks might have, including, Peter, obviously, the admissions process and, a couple of things in the news recently that, may have people wondering, setting aside the financial aspect of what's the admissions process evolving to. You talked about it a little beforehand, but, we have these dummies now bribing, these rich, deep-pocketed people, bribing people to get their kids into school, caught by the feds, thankfully. And now you have an Asian group suing Harvard, I believe, saying they're being discriminated against. What would you say to a parent or a guardian who's saying, who asks you, hey, Peter, is this thing, you know, we know these may be isolated, but how fair, set aside money, how fair is the admissions process?
Well, I think if you consider the fact that there are roughly 3,500 bricks and mortar colleges and universities around the country, and that there are roughly 2.1, 2.2 million students each year attempting to go to college, that the process for the vast majority of those students at those colleges is fair. You know, 80 to 85% of the students who want to go to college find that the path to college is navigable without any interruption like we've been reading about lately. Where we see the anomalous situations are with the families that are insistent upon shoehorning their kids into schools that are insanely selective. They admit one out of 20. Well, my kid needs to be one of the 20. And what, my kid's not good enough to be admitted through the regular process? Well, here's some money. And, you know, it's too bad. Unfortunately, the culture that's become pervasive in the very highly selective schools with regard to, again, I talk about quality is reflected by selectivity, which in my mind is not a good reflection. But still, the notion is my kid needs to go there. It's part of my parent report card. I've done well if I've gotten my kid into this school or that school. Means that there are some individuals who lose track of their ethical attachment and or their legal attachment, and just do whatever it takes to make this work. And it happens. It doesn't happen often. It's ugly, and it's unfortunate. But again, I think that institutions need to take a good look internally at the messaging that they send to the world about their institutions and access to their institutions.
Peter, in the couple of minutes we have left, tell us a little about your website and your organization, bestcollegefit.com.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I started working with this concept about 12 years ago, and I regard myself as a student advocate. I don't care where kids go to college. My objective is to teach them and their parents how to think critically about themselves in the process so they can make good decisions about where to apply and how to compete for admission. There's so much that is kind of left on the table, if you will, at the end of this process, because a lot of kids allow themselves to engage in the somewhat random process of applying to college. The degree to which they bring a sense of purpose, know why you want to go to college, know what you want to achieve, not necessarily in terms of a career or a major, but understand the importance of education in your life. And when you can articulate that to colleges and demonstrate that there's a synergy between what you want and what they have to offer, you know, things can work. And so I've developed some programs that high schools have found very helpful for their junior college orientation programs for students and parents in kind of developing a roadmap for families in this process. And I've created some teaching tools that help to give some greater insight into how different aspects of the process are managed by colleges and universities, and also how families might interpret that process. So it's been a lot of fun for me to meet people around the country and to understand the challenges that they feel, and to talk to students about their dreams and aspirations. And one of the trickiest things that students often will present is, you know, I feel like I have the credentials to compete at this school, but I don't know how to set myself apart.
Yeah.
And my response to the student is always, well, you're looking in the wrong place. Quite often they know themselves by their resumes, but the resume will be very evident in the application. It's what we find in the heart that makes the biggest difference. So I'm trying to help kids understand to reflect and get a better handle on who they are before they even attempt the college admission process.
Well, Peter, thank you. Your presentation that I sat in on that night with my son and his mom was really good, and continue good luck.
Well,
the website, bestcollegefit.com. Peter Van Buskirk has been the guest. Peter, thank you, and continue good luck. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye. All right, there you go, folks.